Good evening, folks, and welcome to The Watcher. This is episode 13. Can you believe it? I am Connor, and this is Fan.
Hey, what's happening?
So, what are we talking about?
Oh, today, you know, we have the primaries coming up for presidential election this year, and I thought it'd be kind of cool to talk about presidential electioneering.
All right, I'm very into this one. I'm very, very excited about this one. But before we get into it, I want to give a shout out to the USA Singers. If you aren't familiar with them, you're in for a treat. Check out at the USA Singers on Twitter, because they've got a pinned tweet that can show you. There's like a link to their stuff on iTunes and Spotify and stuff. Can't really recommend them enough. Don't want to spoil it. Go and check them out. That's our big recommendation for the month. We'll be mentioning them all month, actually. Also, as we've done before, just a quick word to mention Lance Cooper. He is at Escaped Matrix on Twitter. You'll know him through the Save Flint Challenge hashtag. He and the people working with him have provided tremendous amounts of relief and clean water to Flint, but they have incredible things that they're still looking to do, and they're continuing to work on it. He is tireless. If you have a look at the things he's achieved already, it's unbelievable. He really needs your help. If you can retweet, if you have $5, if you have $20, if you have $100, that's great. If you have $0 and you have a retweet, that is still something that still counts. You never know who it can reach. Please do what you can to help him out. All right, I'm off the soapbox, and now it's your turn.
Well, that was a pretty good soapbox, though, buddy.
Thanks, man.
Well, you know, electioneering, right? There's going to be a huge, huge trope of Democratic candidates this year.
Oh yeah.
And, well, yeah, there are, and it makes sense. Really, generally speaking, Trump is very weak politically right now. Uh-huh. 40% approval ratings. Elections do not win.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, they just don't. You know. You can ask any politician ever, and they will tell you that since the advent of modern polling. So what I wanted to talk about was the process of the primary process, just kind of get a little bit of detail to take a bit of a dive into the primary process. And then I wanted to go into the actual electioneering. The reason I wanted to is because I see sometimes candidates will say that they've raised $23 million in one quarter. Well, that's like almost $100 million a year. Why do they need all that money?
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's for reasons that most people don't suspect. So I thought towards the latter half of the show, we'd talk about that.
All right. Hook me up.
Okay. So the primary process at first is first what we're going to talk about. The primary process is generally the same for both parties in that you go from state to in the basics, you know, you go from state to state, yeah, and people vote on who they want their nominee to be. And whoever gets the most votes becomes the nominee, right?
Right.
Generally, since the 1970s, it used to be before the 70s that the Democratic Party, they didn't even have a primary process. They just picked their next person.
Oh. Like,
the party leadership would pick their next candidate. And that was what it was like for most of American history, really. The general public didn't even get to pick who they wanted to be their presidential candidate.
Okay.
And that was ended because of the infamous dark or backroom cigar smoke filled deals that were going on. I don't remember exactly the last candidate to be selected in that fashion, but there was a lot of backlash about that because they were trounced in an election because the candidate was so bad, but the establishment had picked them. The Democratic establishment had picked them.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of backlash within the party to change the process. And one of the things that so people that have power are very loath to let go of said power.
Yeah.
And that's why we have superdelegates still in the Democratic Party primary process, because the people that were making those decisions previously still wanted to have a hand in making those decisions.
Okay. So what is a superdelegate?
A superdelegate is someone of middle or major importance within the party, that their vote counts as much as a delegate that is given as a what they call a pledge delegate. Okay, we'll jump back just a little bit. Let's say that you're voting in a primary process in your state. Uh-huh. You have a certain amount of delegates that go to the convention, and those delegates are pledged to vote for whoever their state won.
Okay.
Generally speaking, we're going to get a little more detail in that, but generally speaking, that's the difference between a pledge delegate and a superdelegate. A superdelegate is, we'll say, well, I'm just going to grab some names off the top of my head, okay? Like previous presidents are always superdelegates, previous Democratic presidents, okay. Vice presidents, secretaries of state, cabinet members, they're always superdelegates. The number is relatively constant, which would be I think would be the best way of putting it. But people that weren't in administrations are sometimes superdelegates too, like not really high level donors, but people who only did a little bit of time in administration, maybe a long time ago, like Donna Brazile is a superdelegate.
Okay.
And she hasn't been in electoral politics in a long, long time.
Okay.
So the point of the superdelegates was to prevent the people of the party, the voters of the party, it's to prevent them from making a terrible decision in the superdelegates' minds.
Okay, so it's a counterbalance.
It is. It's debatable whether that's even democratic.
Yeah. Yeah.
But that is the system they've chosen for themselves.
Okay.
Interestingly, there's been a big push lately, and they did just change the rules around superdelegates. Interestingly, there's been a big push lately to get rid of the superdelegates in the Democratic Party. I personally tend to agree with that statement, except, and I'll tell you why the except when we talk about how the Republicans do their primaries.
Okay. All right.
But Bernie didn't lose because of superdelegates. Bernie lost because he didn't get as many primary votes as Hillary did.
Okay. That's interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a lot of that perception. Well, it's perception.
Yeah, and the narrative, like the weight of narrative. Yeah.
Politics, baby. It's all about the narrative.
Mm-hmm.
So Bernie put that narrative out to I don't know why I'm not in Bernie's head, but Bernie did put that narrative out during the 2016. I remember him talking about it. We're hoping to get past the superdelegates or whatever. That, in a nutshell, is the Democratic presidential primary process.
Okay.
The same states vote in the same order generally. You have Iowa, New Hampshire, and North Carolina? Is it right? South Carolina, Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina, I believe. And those three states are supposed to be a representative example of the regional tastes of America.
Okay.
Yet small enough to get a large amount of votes in quickly. I personally would prefer if every state did it on the same day.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of money that would be lost if they did that. So, and we'll get into that in the second half.
Okay.
Like, I don't think that's going to change because there's just too much money involved in drawing that process out.
Right.
So, we'll move over to the Republican side. Okay. And okay. So the Republican primary process is a little more pure Democratic in that it is 99.9% what the people vote for.
Okay.
The people of the party.
Uh-huh.
But interestingly, it has gotten them shot in the foot occasionally, like it is right now.
Yeah.
So what I want to do is talk just a bit about the Republican, because the Republican Party has that basically popular vote. They are they're constantly tweaking their system. It doesn't get tweaked as much in the Democratic Party, maybe when states vote when or when states can vote at the same time, that kind of thing. But generally in the Democratic Party, they've kept that process the same since the 70s. The Republicans not so much because it's strictly popular vote driven, they've ended up with some real dudders like halfway through the season. And I'll give you a prime example. Whenever they have a straw poll in Iowa at the first primary or before the first primary, and then they'll go to the first primary in Iowa.
Yeah.
Usually their most far right candidate wins.
Okay.
Like the year that Mitt Romney ended up winning the nomination, the front runner from Iowa into the next few states was Michelle Bachmann.
Okay. Okay. I just object anyway. As an outsider, it sounds wrong to me, the idea of having bellwether states.
It sounds wrong to me as an insider as well. I'm not really a fan of that.
Yeah, it feels like it unbalances democracy by putting too much weight on the few.
On small states too. Small states with not heavy population.
Yeah.
And like you take a state like South Carolina, the politics in that state are notoriously ruthless. Like they are dirty pool there all the time.
Right.
Yeah, it's a terrible, terrible political state as far as like, you know, playing by the rules.
Uh-huh.
So taking the example of Michelle, but I'm not going to talk over and over again about the differences that have happened every election cycle for Republicans.
Yeah.
We'll start at 2012 with their quote postmortem, right?
Okay. Yeah.
Are you familiar with this postmortem that they did after the 2012 election?
Only in that you and I have touched on it in our own conversations, but let's go over it.
Okay, and I'll do it real quick.
Yeah.
The Republican Party by 2012 had figured out that they were in a real demographic. They had a real problem with demographics because by then they had already become a nativist party and a primarily white party and a primarily Christian party and a primarily pro-business party. They discovered that as the demographics of America were going to change, are going to change and are changing, that they were going to lose more and more voters as their core voters died off and they didn't gain new voters.
Yeah.
And it was really, really well illustrated by the Romney election of 2012, actually. You had Michelle Bachmann coming off as a front runner right off the bat, and she's loony, just loony. And really, as a political party, that's not your best face forward.
Yeah.
And if the media is trouncing on who's winning a particular primary and it's your crazy person, you're not appealing to – you're immediately turning off a certain segments of voters.
Yeah.
So what they did was is they decided rather than take the – they could have taken – I mean even in their postmortem, they even wrote things like if we don't change – actually, I'm going to use their words because it's a little obscene. If we don't change our messaging – notice they didn't say policies.
Right.
They said if you change their messaging, they're going to lose those voters for a generation. And they're right. But it's also their policies. That's a whole other day. Actually, we probably already talked about that in some form or shape.
Yeah, I think it's something we've kicked around a couple of times, actually, that gulf.
Yeah. So rather than take that lesson from it, the Republican Party took the lesson from it that they needed to tweak their primary system.
Okay.
Yeah. Because Mitt Romney didn't win because he was a vulture capitalist, as they like to call him on the Democratic side. Yeah. He didn't lose because he was a vulture capitalist and a cruel and maybe not cruel, but an out of touch billionaire. I mean, I don't know him. I shouldn't say he's cruel, but definitely an out of touch billionaire. The Republican Party didn't take that lesson. They took the lesson was that they let the crazy people get too much prominence first. Like if they'd have gone with Mitt Romney right off the bat, they figured they might have won.
Yeah.
They also thought that their process was too long. They thought that it took too much time for their actual nominee to be selected and that it was giving the Dems an advantage in the general because they were coming up with their actual nominee first.
Right.
Which I guess maybe esoterically that might be true, but given that a candidate is not allowed to spend money on a general election until after the actual convention, I don't find a lot of truth in that assessment of their primary process.
Okay.
But what they did was to fix it, they shortened their primary process and they made more states winner take all states. And that was talked about really heavily during the 2016 election, actually, the winner takes all. Proportionally.
Okay.
And some states give it out winner take all. Whoever wins the state gets it all as long as you cross a certain percentage threshold of popular vote, like 43% or whatever it might be.
Okay.
So that's how Trump ran away with it because the field was so wide like what the Republicans had done was is they truncated their timetable. They shortened it out, right? And they shortened up the amount of time that proportional delegate states had to vote, so that the winner take all states had a longer time than was what they were and voted earlier. So what they were hoping was is that they would have a front runner right away.
Oh, okay.
And it worked. Trump was the front runner quick.
Yeah.
But it only worked. Well, right. It only worked because there were so many people in the primaries that the vote was split enough that he didn't really have to win much of the vote to get the winner take all states.
Wow.
Like he never won over 50. Well, I shouldn't say never, but for the first half of the primary process, Trump didn't get more than 50% of the vote in any state.
But it looked like a sweep.
Right, because he just got more than everyone else.
Okay.
Not combined, individually.
Yeah.
And it did. It looked like a sweep. It really did. And by the time they were halfway through the primary process, it was a sweep. There was the one last state, as a matter of fact, the state I live in, Indiana, was the last state that he actually had one person still competing against him, and that was Ted Cruz. Past that, it was just Trump on the ticket for all the primaries.
Yeah.
And I would say, to Ted Cruz's good judgment, this was a decent state for him to try to put a last stand on. There's a lot of evangelicals that his type of politics appealed to in this state.
Okay.
But it just didn't work out. It was too late.
Yeah.
Now, as far as Dem rules changes, they did make a change to the rules this cycle in that super delegates can. Okay. If you go to a convention, they call out. I don't know if you watched the last conventions.
No.
But what they do is they call out state by state and ask how many votes for each candidate by state. By the time the convention comes around, you know who the nominee is going to be. So it's just ceremony, right? But for the Republican convention, it was a ceremony. Trump really never got over 50% of the vote. So there were people, especially like Ted Cruz, who had entertained the idea of a contested convention.
Okay.
Interestingly, that's the entire reason that Paul Manafort got hired. It's because he had convention experience. Well, on the surface, that's the reason Paul Manafort got hired.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's see. Like
that was the reason given. That would be the better way to put it now.
Yeah.
But the Dems changed it this year that the superdelegates cannot vote in the first round of call-outs at the convention.
So what does that mean?
What would happen in a Dem convention, like what happened last year was that whoever is chosen to call out the states and say, you know, who your votes for in Massachusetts, who your votes for, and then every Massachusetts delegate stands up and they give the guy a mic, the leader, and he says, our votes are going to such and such and such, right? Well, behind the scenes, these superdelegates would be voting at the same time. They would be putting their votes in at the convention.
Okay.
So what you had was a lot of jockeying during the primary season to get superdelegates in addition to actual voters.
Right, okay.
So now they cannot vote in the first round of a contested convention.
Okay.
So like if let's just for instance, if Biden, the two most popular candidates right now, it's way too early to tell, but the two most popular candidates right now are Biden and Bernie Sanders. If they were to go in there with a 50-50 split or a 49-51 split or something, the superdelegates could not vote until the first round of voting was over. If it were still to be contested at the end of the first round of voting at the convention, then the superdelegates can weigh in and they'll choose the candidate that they like.
Okay.
Which seems fairish to me. If it's a split decision, somebody's got to decide it, you know?
Seems fairer.
The fairer, yeah. That's for sure.
Yeah.
It's really, it was a dirty thing. It's much better now than it used to be. I really would, I'm glad that I live in the times that I do now for that sort of process rather than maybe the 60s, because I would be really mad if someone was thrusting a candidate upon me every time.
Yeah, it sours the power of your vote a little bit.
It gives you no vote in the primary process.
Yeah. Oh, sorry. I mean, by the time you actually go to the booth, you know what I mean? Your vote feels diminished because you didn't have much of a hand in choosing what you're going to be choosing between, so to speak.
Kind of a hold your nose vote.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. It's funny. Since then, the true trope, although it's switched now, but until the Obama years, the conventional political wisdom was always that Democrats fall in love, Republicans fall in line. We've talked about that.
Yeah.
And I think that that's ironic that that has completely switched.
I'm just thinking about that. Yeah, it is funny, actually.
But like when Hillary ran, it was well understood it was her turn.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think that might have been what turned a lot of people off, is that they felt like it was a preordained thing they didn't have a choice in. Of that, of not off of Hillary, off of the system, I mean.
Yes.
Yeah, I don't mean turn people off of Hillary. I mean turn people off of the system. They felt like they weren't really getting the voice that they were used to having.
Yeah.
And you take and then interestingly, John McCain's turn was never right.
Yeah.
Like they were never going to let that guy be president. You know, the Republicans were never going to let that guy be president because he's kind of volatile, you know. But yeah. Interestingly, when he ran against Obama, he came from way, way, way behind to win that primary.
Yeah, I mean, say this for the Republicans. At least you know that they never have and never will give you a volatile president.
Oh, yeah. They're just so awesome about the regular, just like run-of-the-mill, boring presidents, aren't they?
Yeah.
Yeah.
They've got that going, at least.
Okay, so we talked about the primaries, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so the other thing that influences our primary system to an obscene level, in my opinion, is the media. Mm-hmm. And I say that you and I talk about the horse race, the constant competition that the media gives the viewer to keep the eyeballs.
Yeah.
It makes me sick to my stomach when literally 1 week after an election, the media will start talking about who's going to be in the next one.
Yeah.
Like, I'd rather you start reporting on policies.
Yeah.
But that's not competition. That's just reporting. Like, there's no horse race to that.
Yeah. And, the horse race takes the place of keeping people informed.
Yeah. Yeah. It's the old, it's funny. I read that article just came out just a couple days ago about Fox News and the White House and how they're like this symbiotic self-feeding loop of craziness relationship.
Oh, yeah, I didn't read that, but yeah.
Yeah, I'll send it to you.
Please.
It's a really, really good read.
I'd like to.
One of the things that struck me about it was that when Rupert Murdoch first started the station Fox News, he wanted it to be salacious like a tabloid.
Okay.
Like it's modeled after things like The Inquirer and the World, I don't know, whatever the crazy black and white one is. I don't even know if they're printing anymore. World Daily News or whatever.
Weekly World News?
Weekly World News, yeah, with the Bat Boy. Yeah, good call, brother. Good call.
Yeah, I know about it because of So I Married an Ex-Murderer. That's the only reason I know that's a paper.
I love that movie.
Yeah, me too. All right, so yeah, go on.
It's modeled after that, and as well it is. Like the reason that the Inquirer sits at the register is because it's an impulse buy, you know?
Yeah.
And it's an impulse buy because it has salacious, crazy, grab-your-eyes kind of headlines.
Yeah.
So that is the same thing with Fox News.
Yeah.
So if anyone perpetuated the horse race into modern political news coverage, it would be the fault of Fox News. Because before the advent of Fox News, political coverage was pretty boring, my friend. Like, you had to really be into it.
Really?
Yeah. And it was small too. They didn't, like, you didn't get whole 24-hour news cycles about one news story.
Right. That's interesting to me.
Well, CNN, they changed the world. CNN changed the world with a 24-hour news model so dramatically, it's hard to even describe. You can only tell the same story so many times. So you, like, you have to find other stories, and you have to find something else to grab eyeballs.
Yeah, and I don't want to tangent too much here, so I'm allowing myself 15 seconds, but I'm going to go over. But it seems like such a shame, because an actual 24 hours of news seems like there's such potential in exploring. You could just explore lesser seen stories, you know, to fill that time. But that's not what happens at all.
I agree with that. I think that the John Oliver show model, the Last Week Tonight model.
Yeah.
Is genius.
Yeah. Or like Hasan Minhaj. I think he's my favorite sort of news digest show at the moment. He's overtaken John Oliver recently. But yeah, that sort of thing, you know, looking at something in a crazy amount of detail and devoting the time.
Yeah, you have to. You have to. I would say that it was probably different 100 years ago. Well, no, I won't go 100 years ago. We'll say like in the 40s or something. It might have been a little different because the policies that were being put into place were the beginnings of the policies we have now.
Yeah.
So I would say the complexity was probably lower as far as like reporting it.
Right. Okay.
But now, I mean, the bureaucracy is so huge, and the policies have to cover in, fit into that bureaucracy. So everything becomes really, really, really complex. And there's so many players outside of the government now that you just have to take a deep dive into everything you read about.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, like, one of the things that I'm at the verge of repeating myself here, but my dad used to have Sky News on all the time, you know, which is like the 24-hour news over here. And I would see it, and, you know, it'd be on just for hours and hours and hours at a time. And the thing that really burned my ass about it was really surface stuff most of the time. It was, they never go anywhere with it. They just tell you something, and then 10 minutes later, they tell you the same thing again, but they don't go into any detail. They don't get any further with it until it's time for the next thing.
My media strategy, because you're totally right. One of my media strategies is basically on the weekends, I just kill the news.
Yeah.
I watch a couple of Sunday morning programs that I've watched for years because they are informative and smart, whether I agree with what they're saying or not. They're informative and smart. But generally speaking, movies are for family, and I mean, weekends are for family and movies and doing stuff.
Yeah.
I don't do political news on weekends. It's the same thing that happened all week anyway. All the political people are at home.
Yeah. So yeah, sorry, I took us on a long and winding tangent there, but
actually, I'm glad you did. I think that's important. I think it's important for people to realize that you can't glue, if you're getting the same story 24/7, you can't glue yourself to it. Or you're just getting the same story over and over again, you know?
Yeah, and it's weird because it does. You know, they've geared it so carefully that it's firing off all these dopamine receptors in your brain, and you're like, well, I'll catch the next segment. But you don't have to catch the next segment because you caught it 25 minutes ago.
Yeah, you sure did. Yeah, you sure did. And you might get a slightly different analysis from a different panel member, but nothing really, you know, warrant you spending your time on it.
Yeah.
Okay. It was a good tangent, though. I mean, that was important.
Thanks.
So I think so we've established that the primary process lasts about a year, right? Mm-hmm. Generally speaking, there are rules within it that parties use to manipulate or encourage particular outcomes. There is a media machine that stands to make money from this horse race.
Yeah.
So they thrust it upon us. Now, the other thing about that horse race is the money that's involved in the media. Now, we're going to go on to that just in a little bit when we talk about we'll go into it in greater detail, rather, when we talk about the electioneering itself, like the process of getting elected from a candidate's point of view. But it is important to note that it is in a news network's best interest to start the election cycle as soon as humanly possible so that they can sell advertising dollars as soon as humanly possible.
Yeah. Okay. Can't argue with that.
Because that's just money rolling in, yo.
Yeah.
Like as soon as somebody hits an exploratory committee, once they're out of the exploratory committee, which is the a federal law mandated phase of I'm looking at becoming president, because then you have to start accounting for the dollars in a specific way.
Yeah.
Right. Like if you're donor dollars are highly regulated as far as how you spend them.
Okay. Yeah.
How you get them. If you're the actual candidate, if you're a super PAC or an affiliated PAC or a, what they call a community action group, not so much.
Yeah. Great.
And yeah, we'll get into that, though.
Yeah, sounds great. Yeah.
It's awful. Yeah. Citizens United broke that wide open, as everyone knows, and it has become even more obscene since then. So we talked a little bit about the primary process. Well, I wanted to talk a little bit about the voter getting people to the polls, the get out the vote process, which is an ongoing process that goes throughout the entire primary season and then into the election season as well. You've heard the term ground game, right?
No.
Okay. Sometimes you'll see, and I'll use Tom Perez because he's the most, because he is the current DNC chair, or Ronna Daniels, whatever she calls herself, since Trump made her get rid of her name. But she's the chairperson of the RNC, right? And when you see them on television and they'll say, well, how are you guys doing? You know, like, how's it coming out? Is everything, you know, you guys feel good about this season, this election season? And the first thing they'll start talking about is how strong their ground game is. Okay. The ground game is the people that make phone calls and knock on doors.
Okay. It's intuitive. Sure.
For sure. A human is more prone to remember someone coming to their door than someone calling them.
Makes sense. It would annoy me X amount more. So, yeah.
Exactly. No, that's exactly right. Yeah, that's exactly right. It annoys you enough that you don't forget, you know?
Yeah.
And whether it's for a guy you like or not, you're still going to remember somebody came to your door.
Yeah.
A phone call, you can forget that real easy.
Yeah.
So what they do is these parties, okay? We're leaving the primary process and moving into the general election process now. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So what these parties do is they specifically, and this was something that actually Obama pioneered. They specifically micro target voters they know are either on the fence or they know are reliable voters, but don't show up.
Okay.
That's how get out the vote works. You either convince people to vote for you that you aren't sure going to, but have a predilection to do so. For instance, in the Obama 2008 run, they had gone to the point of paying for people's like spending habits, like data on people's spending habits.
Which is one of the reasons that they talk a lot about how Obama's 2008 research sort of set some precedents that ended up becoming scary in Trump times.
Yeah. Standard stuff now. That's standard the way it is now. And so let's say, for instance, you were a Republican candidate and you were a statewide candidate. Okay. Like we'll use Mitch McConnell as an example. Okay. We'll bring it to the state level because it's a little easier. It's a smaller group, you know? So Mitch McConnell, he's not going to waste money sending people knocking on doors in neighborhoods that he knows are Democratic and not going to vote for him, right?
Yeah.
That's just a waste of his money.
Yeah.
Because you have to pay those people, or you at least, at the very least, you have to pay for this. A lot of those people are volunteers. But at the very least, you have to pay for the documentation you're going to give out and the campaigning materials and the yard sign stuff.
Yeah.
So why waste your money in a Democratic neighborhood, right? Well, what Obama's team figured out was, you're right, we're not going to waste our money in that whole neighborhood, but four houses on that street voted Democratic last time.
Yikes, yeah.
So we're going to go to just those houses, which is smart in a whole number of ways. A, you're increasing the chances that they might show up to vote, and which is a big deal when only 40% of your country votes in a presidential election. And B, those people talk to their neighbors. Well, Obama's guy showed up and he said he was going to do this and that. Yeah. And it may not change your neighbor's mind, but at least it opens up the conversation that other people are running.
Yeah.
So the other side of that coin, that what I what we will call micro-targeting, is just targeting. And for instance, using Mitch McConnell again, how come Mitch McConnell consistently wins re-election in a state where his approval ratings are terrible? How come? How does he do that? You know, he's never lost an election.
Slippery fuck.
Never. Like, even when he was just like a little community idiot running for office, he still didn't lose an election.
Wow.
Mitch McConnell is a master of finding the right population of people to vote for him. And that's best illustrated by he does a whole lot of legislating specifically designed to people in specific parts of the state that are most populous that might vote for him.
Wow.
So, like, why is there a new bridge going to Cincinnati? Well, that's Mitch McConnell. Well, why? Because people on the Kentucky side of that bridge tend to vote Republican, and he wants to keep their votes. So he made their lives easier.
Wow.
Now, I'd like to take a Trump minute here if I could.
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay. Trump has this habit, people have noticed more recently, that he will disseminate emergency funds on a political basis.
Yeah.
Right? That's unheard of. That's not something presidents do, especially if they want to win re-election. Like, it hurts him electorally to do that. But regardless, I'm pretty sure that Trump, who was a political novice, by the way, learned that from Mitch McConnell.
Yeah.
Well, Mitch McConnell and him talk daily.
And so Mitch McConnell
has never lost an election.
Right. So it's like it's the novice misusing the lesson given by the master?
Absolutely.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. That's absolutely what it is. Got the wrong lesson, I guess.
Yeah.
Although maybe not. I mean, it would seem to me that if Mitch McConnell was ignoring the most impoverished parts of his state to maintain his electoral prospects, it seems to me Trump's doing exactly what McConnell does anyway.
Yeah. So what is it, just because it's on a wider scale, it's more it causes more harm to him because it's more visible?
Well, Kentucky is generally a conservative state. So even if Mitch McConnell ignores, you know, we'll say 80% of the voters in the state, 60% of those voters are going to vote for him anyway.
Yeah. What are they going to do? Vote Democrat?
Right. Right. Yeah. No, because Dems are evil.
Right.
According to Newt Gingrich.
Right.
You know, we're talking two generations now of being told that Dems are evil.
Yeah.
Oh, no, they're not going to vote for Dems. The ones that he's doing these little projects for or sending legislative money and, you know, federal money down to, those are the folks that generally vote Republican but may not.
Right.
Suburban voters. So, yeah, that's what they do, is they target specific – that's also a reason why – let's say a specific part of maybe a defense budget is going to be cut. That's also a reason why House Member A in, you know, somewhere in maybe Montana or something, who has like some sort of military spending in his district, that's why he'll protect that spending.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Which is one of the reasons we have so much trouble bringing down budgets, is because members protect their districts to, you know, be reelected.
Yeah.
Basically.
Yeah.
The hard choices don't get you reelected. The easy choices do.
Yeah. Yeah. The greater good choices don't necessarily get you reelected.
No, because they're hard. They don't please everybody.
Yeah.
Which is another reason Congress gave up its war say-so, is because it doesn't please everybody. Oh, that's a whole other. I actually had thought about maybe doing today about the state of warfare in America and how much it has changed over the years, but I think that's for another episode.
I'll put it on the board, though.
Yeah, for sure, because this one's been hot on my mind. I was inspired by Rachel Maddow's book, Drift. To read a whole lot about that. That's a really good book. It's our only book, and it's a good one. I'd recommend it.
I must read it.
So we talked a little bit about like the electioneering process as far as like how the parties behave, right?
Yeah.
And now I want to get into the money, which is really what's the most broken part of our election process. The parties can change rules and whenever they want. So that I don't really consider that broken in as much as that it can be constantly tweaked.
Yeah.
But it's to the whims of the party. The targeting of voters through legislative accomplishments is always going to happen because the number one goal of every politician is to be reelected. So that's always going to happen. That's just part of the system.
Uh-huh.
It will never go away. But the money can. Now, why did Obama have to raise close to $1 billion to be elected president? That's what I asked myself.
Yeah.
Why do you need so much money? Advertising doesn't cost that much. They actually get cut rates by law. So why? Why is there so much money in it? Well, we're going to start with just the outside groups.
Uh-huh. Okay.
We're going to start with the PACs. Excuse me. So what a PAC stands for, Political Action Committee, okay?
Uh-huh.
And interestingly enough, if a PAC reports that it does less than 50% electioneering, it is considered a community action group rather than a political group, and it doesn't have to report its donors.
Fuck that. Go on.
Definitely a fuck that.
Yeah.
Because that is messed up. Like, nobody checks it. You know, like there's not the Federal Election Commission, the FEC, is so defanged by design, and not just conservative design, by the way. By design, it's so defanged that even if a PAC were to be caught doing more electioneering than community action, I'm not real sure there'd be ramifications other than you have to disclose your donors, which, I mean, big deal, right?
Right.
If the election's already over, big deal.
Yeah.
So that's how you get guys like the Mercers or the Kochs able to drop untold amounts of money into these political action groups. And they're really it's really, really, really specific too. So like, let's say you see a commercial on TV that says, call your senator and tell them to stop doing this or tell them to do this.
Yeah.
That's not electioneering. That's community action.
Yeah. Okay. Glad we made that distinction.
Right. There is technically a distinction there, right? I mean, just
sure. Sure.
But when it rolls over into campaign season, because these people have put out X amount of ads over the course of the year that have said, call your congressperson or whatever, rather than vote for somebody, then they can spend 49% of the rest of their money during the election season with vote for somebody ads.
Right.
Are you with me?
Oh, yeah.
So, like, when it matters, they can totally be political and nobody checks up on it.
Yeah.
Because it's less than, 50% of their allotted expenditures for politics rather than community action. Although, I would also point out that when you see these, quote, community action, end quote, commercials, generally speaking, they're very partisan.
Yeah.
And they're not as community action oriented as they purport to be.
Right.
Yeah, they'll basically be like a hit ad on a politician, and then they'll say, call this politician to fix that.
Yeah.
So really, they're just politically acting the entire year round.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, every move they make is, but yeah.
So, like, yeah, very much so. Technically and legally speaking, they're not supposed to coordinate with any particular candidate. And I read a really, really fascinating article There is a certain political action committee. It is a, I would call it a mid-sized political action committee, that currently is creating fake news organization websites in, I want to say, Minnesota, Tennessee, and I forget what the other state is, but they're like the Tennessee website is called the Tennessee Star, and it looks exactly like you would expect to find a newspaper website. Only really all it does is prop up candidates and the people who run the PAC.
Man.
It's very disingenuous.
Yeah. Yeah, to say the least. Yeah.
And as much as I hate to use these two words in succession, it's fake news.
Oh, God. I was just thinking the same thing. I was like, I, even though that's what it is, I hate that the term, that we live with this term now. Yeah.
Interestingly, that term was used before Donald Trump did about Donald Trump during the election, and he co-opted it for himself.
That's interesting.
Like, that's how good he is at messaging. I think that's one of the reasons he slid right into the Republican Party so well, is they become so focused on messaging and winning elections rather than governing that he just fit in like a glove.
Yeah.
As far as getting elected goes.
Yeah. Yeah.
So not only do they have, you know, they have these fake news websites. I really, that term is closely associated with Trump now, but it's a real term, you know?
Yeah. I always want to, this sounds a bit nitpicky, but I always want to qualify it. I always want to say they have these propaganda websites that are masquerading as news websites, because that gets the information across, but I don't have to repeat the term, because I've said this. Look, I've said this before, and I know I'm always saying it, but the thing that hurts me is when I hear a conservative say, well, if fake news isn't a real thing, then why are even liberals talking about it? That really bothers me. But sorry, go on.
Oh, I was contemplating that I'm much lazier than you then, I guess.
I think this entire show is proof that that is not the case, but go on.
Because I thought, well, yeah, that's true, but fake news is only two words.
Yeah. And look how much time it saved us.
Yeah, tons. Yeah, it's right.
Yeah.
Oh, no, I forgot what my other point was about PACs. Oh, yeah, okay. No, that's all right. I think it's important that we quantify those things. Like, I'm glad you said that, because I hate to use a term that has become a pejorative that was actually a valid term that's made into a pejorative. And if you can give me a better way of explaining it without using that term, I'm cool with that.
Okay. Thank you.
So this is a bit of a prediction, but it was something that I read just today, actually. I was kind of boning up on the show a little bit. Uh-huh. And I was reading about how, I don't know if you paid attention to the news about CPAC that just happened.
No.
That is the Conservative Political Action Conference.
Uh-huh.
Are you familiar with it?
Yeah, well, I'm familiar with it. You know, you hear, they're such a boogeyman. You know, I hear stories about them. I occasionally, you know, I'll read articles about some crazy, insane thing that some famous Republican said at a CPAC meeting. That's sort of my familiarity with them, you know?
It's funny, the media reports that it's devolved into like just like this fan zone, you know. It's always been that. Reagan put CPAC on the map, and he's like the original fan zone Republican.
So it's like a Comic-Con for people who hate like anybody that's not like white and straight.
It's a Comic-Con for anybody who considers themselves a conservative.
Sure. Yeah, that's what I said, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Anyway, go on.
So, yeah, but that's exactly what it is. Like, I read an article that some liberal activist had put Trump on the middle stripe of a bunch of Russian flags and handed them out at this year's CPAC. Yeah. And they were flying around, you know?
Yeah,
it's it totally is. It's like a Comic-Con fandom thing. It's ridiculous. I have a friend that went to it, and I want to ask him about it, and I probably will sometime this week, see what his take on it was. He's an actual conservative, and he's a friend of mine, politically conservative, you know, and he's a friend of mine. And I kind of want to know what his take on it is. He was excited to go, but I don't know. I don't know what his take on it would be.
Yeah, he's to hear about that.
Yeah, he's a really smart guy, and I'd like to know what if he feels that there's been a change in it over the years that he's been going to it.
Uh-huh.
So, but anyway, one of the things in reading about this CPAC, this year, they've found a new boogie woman. They don't talk about Nancy Pelosi anymore. They talk about, Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez.
Of course, yeah.
That's right, right?
Yeah, of course.
Awesome. Or is it Alexandria? I don't know. OAC.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I thought you were saying, that's right, she's the new boogie woman. And I was like, yeah, totally she is. But you were just querying your pronunciation? I think your pronunciation is perfect.
Okay, thank you.
Sounds fine.
I want to work on not being lazy with that name.
I do think actually not. I don't mean to like shoot you in the foot with this, but I think generally, like I have a name that everybody mispronounces, and I'm always struck by what a mark of respect it is to just bother to say someone's name correctly. And also the inverse of that is true.
Agreed. No, you're absolutely right. When I was a kid, total digression here, real quick, folks. When I was a kid, I was forced to take my stepfather's last name, and it was spelled J-A-U-C-H, pronounced Yauch.
Okay.
And I really did appreciate when people took the time to at least ask, how do I say this word, you know?
Yeah, it is. It's like it's a real basic thing, but it's a nice little gesture of respect in this hard world we live in, you know?
Agreed. So anyway, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez she's become the new boogeywoman. They broadcast her face all over the CPAC because she's socialist or whatever, right?
Right.
And one of the things they kept hammering on, and this always, this like, I don't know why, but I feel like cooked ground beef is like the perfect description of the current iteration of the Republican Party. But they were hammering on hamburgers because one of the things of the Green New Deal is to get a handle on industrial livestock farming.
Yeah.
No, it's only about 9% of the greenhouse gases, but cows are something like 80% of that 9% through their burps and farts.
Yeah, and globally, you know, livestock farming is one of the biggest driver of deforestation, which is one of those little like factoids you don't hear as often. But yeah, it's disastrous. Livestock farming. I say this as just a ridiculous carnivore, but yeah, livestock farming, we need to grab the reins a little bit, so to speak.
Same, buddy. Same. I was talking to a friend. I was like, maybe we should just all start eating bugs.
Yeah.
It's more protein, healthier protein anyway. So yum. I've occasionally indulged in a bug. It's not a very pleasant experience. So One of the points of the Green New Deal is we need to get a handle on this. I mean, not kill it, of course. People do like their meat and protein is there. And I'm not real sure humans will ever stop eating meat. I mean, that's just because I'm a shameless carnivore as well. So that's not really maybe that's not the best assessment. It's a little one-sided.
Yeah.
But they decided to take that at CPAC and run with it. Like Jerry Falwell said, I got 100 cows, and if anybody ever comes to me, they'll be looking at the other side of my gun or something like that. Or
of course he said that.
Yeah, right, of course. Like this guy's a Christian leader, you know, and I'll just murder anybody that comes for my cows. Ted Cruz, Sebastian Gorka likened the hamburger crisis, and I do air quotes on that.
It's great. It's really good.
To though. Stalin's dream, man. He really did. He said, this is what Stalin wanted but could never achieve.
That fucking guy.
A hamburgerless society.
It's a great phrase and a pretty good album title.
That's our next metal album, by the way.
Yeah.
No,
yeah.
That's a folk album.
Yeah, that's actually our... We're gonna lose some fans. We're going to reverse Dylan by going non-electric.
So... Anyway, the point of it is that she's this boogeyman, right? And how that relates to electioneering is I'll give it to you this way. Uh-huh. Green industries have about $51 billion they'll spend on varying PACs and messaging over the course of this next 2 years.
Sure.
Or this next year. They spend about $51 billion a year in lobbying and PACs, right?
Yeah. The green industry sounds, sounds like a lot of money.
It does sound like a lot of money until you realize that the meat industry spends about $894 billion a year on lobbying and PACs. That's almost $1 trillion a year to support industrial livestock farming.
Wow. My eyes are watering.
That's just what they spend.
Yeah.
How about, by the way, how's about that for a little more system stacked against you? What if they just turn that around to the people that are working for them?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Like, heaven forbid, right?
Oh, absolutely. heaven forbid that they should raise, like, minimum wage by a fucking dollar or $2.
Oh, that gets my goat so bad. Yeah. It's all because of the southern states, too. The southern states, you don't need much, as much to live. So they say, well, you can't do that. You'll kill our economies. Yeah, again, conservative states killing us, you know. Mm-hmm. Really, they just don't want to pay people more. The business interests are like, no, I don't want to pay people more. I won't make as much.
Yeah.
For every dollar more that McDonald's pays, their burgers go up by 10 cents. If the cost were to just be directly to the consumer.
Right.
Burgers again, right? I must be hungry.
I am now. How perverse is that? We have a long conversation about how the meat industry is essentially killing us, killing the entire planet, and both of us are like, hey, you want to get a hamburger after this?
Totally down with a burger. Yeah. So but that's crazy though. $1 trillion. That's craziness. $1 trillion. So this is what we have on the outside going on. Is these big money groups are spending to get their agenda going. And because of Citizens United, they don't even have to disclose that they're doing it. That's obscene enough as it is.
Yes. Yeah.
So now we're going to talk about the candidate and the candidacy. Okay. The actual two people that are running. Why did Obama have to raise $1 billion? Well, one of the reasons he had to raise $1 billion is because he had to create enough ads to fight against $894 billion of, you know, meat industry spending, or, you know, $1 trillion of oil industry spending or whatever. They're going to prop up the other candidate. They're going to prop up their chosen candidate, which would be the Republican, who is probably a fiscal conservative and wants to lower the regulations. So they're all over that.
Right.
Inside a political operation to run for president, there are many, many people. And it's not just a chief of staff or the coffee guy or the pollsters, because they all have like their own internal polls. Do you know about that? Internal versus external polling in a run for president?
Yeah, a little. Give me a tight 37 seconds on it.
It's easier to focus. There's external polling that is done by outside groups, and there's internal polling that is paid for by people inside the campaign. Just that simple.
Okay. I had that wrong. So good. Go on.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what it is, you have to pay for these polls. You know, like, you have to pay for them to be produced. You have to pay for people to create the right questions. You have to pay for people to analyze it. You have to pay for people to, you know, and then there's somebody who's going to take all that information and give it to the candidate so they can make the appropriate decisions and stuff. Sometimes that's why Hillary Clinton would come across as a little rehearsed, because of internal polling and focus grouping.
Okay.
Basically what they've done is they've turned it into an aspect of business.
Okay. Yeah.
That sucks up a lot of money. A lot of money. There's a lot of people involved in that chain. On a Republican side, it's totally different. They do have those people, and they do have people that ask for the donations, but on the Republican side, there is a wealth of people not affiliated with campaigns who ask for money for campaigns because that's legal.
Oh, come on.
And it really kicked off strong, I would say, during the George W. Bush presidency. But there's not, and it's not even a cottage industry anymore. There's an entire industry of people on the, quote, conservative, end quote, side of the political ledger that are basically just grifters who ask for donations 24/7, 365, and spend about 10% on candidates and the rest of it on paying themselves and asking for more donations.
Wow.
Totally legal.
Great. Good.
Yeah. Yeah. It's totally legal as long as you don't give the impression that that's not what you're doing.
Okay.
Like, if someone were to start a committee for, we'll just pick Michelle Bachmann again because she's gone. If someone were to start a committee for Michelle Bachmann, and let's say they raised $3 million over the course of a year, they could spend $700,000 of that paying themselves. They could spend another $250,000 of it to roll it back into their process to get more. Mm-hmm. And then they can give $50,000 to Michelle Bachmann. Or that's not true. They couldn't give $50,000 to Michelle Bachmann because that's overspent, over donating. They could spend that $50,000 on things that support Michelle Bachmann.
Right. Yeah.
And unless somebody complains, they just keep getting away with it. There's a whole grifter industry on the right now that is taking the money from groups, basically.
Yeah.
That's why you constantly read about fundraising emails for the Trump reelection committee. Now, I'm not saying that they're that kind of group. I don't really know the details of that group. That's Brad Parscale's group. I don't know the details of how they spend their money. I'm sure that if it was inappropriate like that, I would have probably read about it by now. But that's one of the reasons that donations are asked for basically year round, is because there is this cottage industry of people soaking people for their money.
What a nightmare.
It is, entrepreneurship, right?
Yeah.
I say that quite sarcastically.
Yeah.
Okay, so we've established that there's a whole inside a campaign, there is a whole group of people that just do polling, right? And focus groups.
Yeah.
That's quite a bit of money. But not billion, not $1 billion. Where is all that money going, right? It's going to a place. You always talk about in economics, the middleman's the guy who makes the money.
Uh-huh.
Here is the chain of advertising for a presidential campaign.
Okay.
The chain of possession of dollars or intellectual property from the candidate saying, I want it here on these airwaves, to them getting to the airwaves. Here's the chain.
Okay.
The chief of staff or whoever the political advisor is says, we need more ads in Minneapolis. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
They tell it to the person on staff who is in charge of advertising. A person who is in charge of it. Now, these are very highly paid people. We're talking about top level campaign officials now. Okay.
Sure. Okay. Yeah.
Okay. So they're making, like, the higher level ones are being paid hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars for this campaign. Like Steve Schmidt, that dude's a millionaire for a reason. He hasn't won very many campaigns, but still he's a millionaire.
Right.
So, they say to the person, the media person, they'll say, all right, I want you to put X amount of dollars into Minneapolis ad buys, okay?
Mm-hmm.
That person then talks to someone on staff who knows people who produce these videos, okay? And they're scientifically designed, with the scary music and the happy music and all that stuff. They're depending on the message that they want to get forth. Now, they have to pay all these people for all this information to design all these ads, right?
Right.
In addition to the people that actually make the ad.
Uh-huh.
Now, some of these candidates, they pay top dollar for, like, Hollywood people to make these ads. Not people you or I would have heard of, but not people most people would have heard of. Behind the scenes people, cinematographers, or, maybe not the really big ones that are up for Oscars and stuff, but the middle of the road guys.
And they don't come cheap.
No, they don't. No, they don't at all. Still, you're not in that place where why does it cost $1 billion, right?
Right.
The reason it ends up costing so much money is because these people that make the ads then turn these ads over to the middleman. And the middleman is the ad buyer. And what that guy does is talks to the television stations to actually buy the ads.
Okay.
Now, remember I told you earlier, those ads are sold at a cut rate.
Yes.
Well, this guy that's the ad buyer, is given a lump sum in addition to his salary to buy these ads. So if he can get a cheaper rate on these ads, he keeps all the rest of the money.
I object to that. Okay.
Yeah, it's obscene, right? I mean, that's obscene, right?
Yeah, yeah.
That's where the money's going. It's going to, like, to say you took a market like LA, right? Uh-huh. Maybe not LA. You have to. Okay, that's not a good example, because in America, if you're in a state that is solidly one color, you don't see a lot of political advertising.
Right. Okay, that makes sense.
But let's say you live in Columbus, Ohio.
Uh huh.
Well, that's a fairly expensive market. It's an industrialized state. A lot of people live in that city. The Columbus, Ohio station covers a broad portion of that state. So generally speaking, you're reaching a lot of eyeballs. That's a fairly expensive ad buy.
Yeah, sounds good.
If you make that same ad buy in Chicago for your candidate and that same ad buy in Milwaukee for that candidate, you've covered the lower Lake Michigan area.
Okay, yeah.
Chicago obviously is going to have a lot higher ad rate, a lot higher price per minute for ads than Columbus, Ohio or Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
Sure, yeah.
So then really you still get this guy, this ad buyer, making tons and tons and tons of cash.
Yeah.
All this money, all this is public record too, man. Like every single dime of this is public record. These people have to claim all this. This isn't a secret. It's right out there in the open. And so when MSNBC tells me that the presidential primary, that the 2020 election started in December of 2018, because they want to sell more ads.
Yeah.
So the perpetuating cycle is that there's just more and more and more money being made and more money being spent.
And people never say no to money.
Generally speaking, that's true. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It actually brings me to, you remember, it was a couple episodes ago, we were talking about income inequality, and I said I have a few ideas about trying to get the money out of our system.
Uh-huh.
Because if you take this, like the reason I mention all these things about all the money going into an election is because that money has to come from somewhere. So then we have these politicians who are spending 40% of their time when they're in D.C. calling for money rather than actual legislating or oversighting or whatever other constitutional duties we set them there for.
They're essentially not doing their job.
They're not doing their jobs. They're sitting in literally a phone bank in the basement of the Capitol building dialing for dollars.
I heard a political comedian many years ago, and I was so young that unfortunately I can't even remember who it was, you know. But he said, essentially, you get hired to work at Honda, at a Honda dealership, and you show up on the first day and you say, "Hey, how's it going? I know you hired me for 40 hours a week. I was thinking I'll be here two mornings a week, actually, but the rest of the time I'm just gonna be like mostly calling like BMW dealerships, Bentley dealerships, that kind of stuff, seeing if I can get a job there. I'm gonna be here for a few years doing that."
Yeah, that's it in a nutshell.
I wish I could remember who said that, because it's so excoriating. It's horrible, but it's so good.
It's true. If you're ex-candidate and you're constantly dialing four or five big businesses and rich people in your district, if you're like a House member, let's just, you know, take it on a smaller level. If you're constantly calling those people for money, then are you going to be more prone to do their bidding, or are you going to be more prone to do the people who didn't give you money's bidding?
Yeah.
What are you going to be in Congress for if your number one goal is to be reelected and you need their money to be reelected? Then you're going to constantly do what they need you to do so that you can consistently get their money.
Yeah.
My solution? Would you like to hear it?
Fuck yeah, I want to hear it.
Free political advertising.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm into that.
I mean, it's really just that simple. Make it illegal for television stations and newspapers and websites and magazines to make it illegal for them to charge for political advertising.
That's great.
Well, it is, generally. I'm hearkened to remember a certain John Oliver episode I saw a year or so ago. You do get some crazy people getting free political advertising.
Listen, I'm old enough to remember when the old joke about Donald Trump was, yeah, he runs for president every time because he gets free advertising.
Well, that's a different kind of advertising.
Because yeah. they have to. Well, yeah, that was they have to mention it. They have to say he's running, you know. But it's free exposure. I remember that in those days.
Interestingly, you should bring that up. One of the major complaints against the media during 2016, and very, very valid in my opinion, was the free political advertising he did get when they ran all of his rallies live.
Yeah. Yeah,
why? Crazy. Because he drew eyeballs.
Yeah.
It really just translated into free political advertising for this guy.
Yeah. And it doesn't even have to translate. Like, it just absolutely is. It what else is it?
Nothing.
Yeah, it's not coverage. It's not informing me.
You're not informing me if you're just running a live feed of somebody talking.
Yeah.
And like somebody who's not supposed to be informing me talking.
Yeah, that's what the press pool is for.
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Do your jobs, you know.
Yeah.
There was a time in America where they didn't run the entire White House press briefing live. They just were there and reported on what mattered.
Yeah.
Or what they considered mattered at the very least. And if you really wanted to know more, you had to, you know, find out for yourself, like a responsible citizen in a democracy should.
Yeah. And contained in that is the implication that you probably have shit to do, so it's handy for you to have an expert run it down for you.
Generally speaking, sir, that's the truth. Generally speaking, that is the truth. Well, that's my thing on electioneering, man. It's the money and how it gets there and the process.
You know, it's weird. It's weird because I can have such a good time getting annoyed. And sometimes I'm like, ah, oh, that was a good one. Ah, my blood is boiling. That's how I feel. Yeah, that was a good one.
I don't know that I have a happy ending to this one, though.
Well, ideas like that, or ideas even adjacent to that or beyond that, that we can't even imagine. And that's where I'm getting a little bit of hope.
Funny you should say that. Alternatively, I was reading today about how back in the days of the Keynesian economy theory, when it was first, you know, starting to become prominent, Keynes wrote an essay about how automation was going to change the way people worked and what they were doing, and unemployment would be or employment numbers would be affected by that. And the author that was writing about that essay said one of the things that always struck me was that you have no idea how to predict what's coming in the future.
Yeah. 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 Absolutely.
I think you're right. I think that the ideas to fix that are either young like mine or just not out there yet.
Yeah.
The problem is we're asking for people whose primary objective is to be reelected to fix the system that causes them to be reelected.
Yeah.
That's why I'm not like so abjectly hopeful about this one. Although, realistically speaking, the hope is always there with an election cycle.
Yeah. And you know, I want to just – sorry, you can actually hear one of my dogs there is screaming to be taken out. but I feel like we're allowed to have a little bit of hope almost as a byproduct of the absolute shit fire that we've been living in. There's such incredible upheaval as a result of the madness that we've seen in the last couple of years that new things are just automatically going to be on the table. There you go.
Agreed.
Well, I had a good time. I hope you did, folks. Thank you very much for listening, for engaging. I'm real quiet on Twitter these days. I'm not on Twitter that much, but you know, please do still reach out because I get a kick out of it. I do.
He does.
He does. All right, folks. Good night, and we'll see you next week.
Yeah, good night, everybody. Bye.